Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 177, a special treat this week. We're doing the greatest hit show number 6. And that means we're going to cover some timely and timeless stories beginning from April 2021 and beyond. So here we go. This from the World Health Organization. Devastatingly pervasive. 1 in 3 women globally experience violence. Violence against women remains devastatingly pervasive and starts alarmingly young, shows new data from the World Health Organization and partners. Across their lifetime, 1 in 3 women, around 736 million, are subjected to physical or sexual violence by an intimate partner or sexual violence from a non-partner, a number that has remained largely unchanged over the past decade. This violence starts early. 1 in 4 young women aged 15 to 24 years who have been in a relationship will have already experienced violence by an intimate partner by the time they reach their mid-20s. Violence against women is endemic in every country and culture, causing harm to millions of women and their families. It has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General. But unlike COVID-19, violence against women cannot be stopped with a vaccine. We can only fight it with deep-rooted and sustained efforts by governments, communities, and individuals to change harmful attitudes, improve access to opportunities and services for women and girls, and foster healthy and mutually respectful relationships. Intimate partner violence is by far the most prevalent form of violence against women globally, affecting around 641 million. However, 6% of women globally report being sexually assaulted by someone other than their husband or partner. Given the high levels of stigma and underreporting of sexual abuse, the true figure is likely to be significantly higher. Inequities are a leading risk factor for violence against women. Violence disproportionately affects women living in low and lower middle income countries. An estimated 37% of women living in the poorest countries have experienced physical and or sexual intimate partner violence in their life, with some of these countries have a prevalence as high as 1 in 2. The regions of Oceania, Southern Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa have the highest prevalence rates of intimate partner violence among women aged 15 to 49. The lowest rates are found in Europe, Central Asia, Eastern Asia, and Southeastern Asia. Violence against women must be prevented. Violence in all its forms can have an impact on a woman's health and well-being throughout the rest of her life, even long after the violence may have ended. It is associated with increased risk of injuries, depression, anxiety disorders, unplanned pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, including HIV, and many other health problems. It has impacts on society as a whole and comes with tremendous costs, impacting national budgets and overall development. Preventing violence requires addressing systemic, economic and social inequalities, ensuring access to education and safe work, and changing discriminatory gender norms and institutions. Successful interventions also include strategies that ensure essential services are available and accessible to survivors, that support women's organizations, challenge inequitable social norms, reform discriminatory laws, and strengthen legal responses, among others. To address violence against women, there's an urgent need to reduce stigma around the issue, train health professionals to interview survivors with compassion, and dismantle the foundations of gender inequality. Interventions with adolescents and young people to foster gender equality and gender equitable attitudes are also vital. Countries should honor their commitments to increased and strong political will and leadership to tackle violence against women on all fronts through sound gender transformative policies, from policies around child care to equal pay and laws that support gender equality, a strengthened health system response that ensures access to survivor-centered care and referral to other services as needed, school and educational interventions to challenge discriminatory attitudes and beliefs, including comprehensive sexuality education, targeted investment in sustainable and effective evidence-based prevention strategies at local, national, regional, and global levels, and strengthening data collection and investing in high-quality surveys on violence against women and improving measurement of the different forms of violence experienced by women, including those who are most marginalized. And the single most important indicator for development in a developing country, the status of women. And women in particular have higher risks of psychosocial stress. This from Science Daily. Stress from work and social interactions put women at higher coronary heart disease risk. Psychosocial stress, typically resulting from difficulty coping with challenging environments, may work synergistically to put women at significantly higher risk of developing coronary heart disease, according to a study by researchers at Drexel University School of Public Health, recently published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. The study specifically suggests that the effects of job strain and social strain, the negative aspect of social relationships on women, is a powerful 1-2 punch. Together, they are associated with a 20% higher risk of developing coronary heart disease. Job strain occurs when a woman has inadequate power in the workplace to respond to the job's demands and expectations. The study also found that high-stress life events, such as a spouse's death, divorce separation, or physical or verbal abuse, as well as social strain, were each independently linked with a 12% and 9% higher risk of coronary heart disease, respectively. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted ongoing stresses for women in balancing paid work and social stressors. We know that from other studies that work strain may play a role in developing heart disease. But now we can better pinpoint the combined impact of stress at work and at home on these poor health outcomes, said senior author Dr. Yvonne Michael. Okay, well, now I'd like to do a series of stories on racial, ethnic, and gender disparities. This from Medical Express. Physicians are more likely to doubt black patients than white patients. When the 21st Century Cures Act was implemented, healthcare providers were required to give their patients free access to all the health information in their medical electronic medical records. This just took effect. Black patients are much more likely than white patients to discover language in those records that indicates they are not believed by their physicians, according to a new study by Johns Hopkins University published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. We set out to see if we could identify linguistic mechanisms through which physicians communicate disbelief of patients in medical records, and, if so, to explore racial and gender differences in the use of such language, said Mary Catherine Beach, a faculty member at the University School of Medicine and Public Health and a core faculty member at the Berman Institute of Bioethics. Our analysis of medical record language suggests black patients are less likely to be believed by physicians. The bias reflected in those medical records may in turn affect care from future clinicians. And next up from Science Daily as well, a new study suggests that when men and women express the same amount of pain, women's pain is considered less intense based on gender stereotypes. In a recent study published in the Journal of Pain, co-authored by Elizabeth Lowson, assistant professor of psychology and director of the Social and Cultural Neuroscience Lab at the University of Miami, researchers found that a patient's pain responses may be perceived differently by others based on their gender. According to gender biases in estimation of others' pain, when male and female patients express the same amount of pain, observers viewed female patients' pain as less intense and more likely to benefit from psychotherapy versus medication as compared to men's pain, exposing a significant patient gender bias that could lead to disparities in treatments. If the stereotype is to think women are more expressive than men, perhaps overly expressive, then the tendency will be to discount women's pain behaviors, Lowson said. The flip side of this stereotype is that men are perceived to be stoic. So when a man makes an intense pain facial expression, you think, oh my, he must be dying. The result of this gender stereotype about pain expression is that each unit of increased pain expression from a man is thought to represent a higher increase in his pain experience than that same increase in pain expression by a woman. Additionally, the study concluded that the gender of the perceivers did not influence pain estimation. Both men and women interpreted women's pain to be less intense. The idea to study disparities in the perception of pain based on a patient's gender was derived from previous research, Lohsen said, that found women are often prescribed less treatment than men and wait longer to receive that treatment as well. I think one critical piece of information that could be conveyed in medical curricula is that people, even those with medical training and other studies, have been found to have consistent demographic biases in how they assess the pain of male and female patients, and that these biases impact treatment decisions. Critically, our results demonstrate that these gender biases are not necessarily accurate. Women are not necessarily more expressive than men, and thus their pain expression should not be discounted. Amen to that. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears now and do four stories related to nutrition. This is from Medical Express. Study finds Americans eat food of mostly poor nutritional quality, except at school. Whether eating out or buying food from the grocery store, Americans of all ages are, for the most part, eating poorly everywhere, except at school. The information comes from a new dietary trend study, which also reveals persistent or worsening disparities in meal quality from restaurants, grocery stores, and other sources, but not school. These worsening trends are by race, ethnicity, and income. By 2018, the most recent year for which national data is available, meals with the lowest nutritional quality came from restaurants, where 65% of adult meals and 80% of children's meals were of poor quality. Entertainment venues and food trucks were the next worst, with 44% of adult meals and 52% of children's meals being of poor nutritional quality. At work sites, 51% of adult meals eaten were of poor dietary quality. Grocery stores were better sources of food, with 33% of adult meals eaten and 45% of children's meals being of poor quality. Schools were best, where only 24% of meals consumed by children were of poor nutritional quality. Schools are now the single healthiest place Americans are eating. This finding is particularly timely given widespread school closures over the last year from COVID-19 and current efforts to safely and fully reopen schools. Our results suggest substantial nutritional harms for millions of kids who have not been consistently receiving meals at school and must rely on other sources. These harms are also disproportionately affect low-income Black and Latinx children, said Dariush Mozafari, and dean of the Friedman School and senior author of the study. Analyzing the diets of about 40,000 adults and 21,000 children between 2003 and 2018, the research team found significant improvements in all nutritional quality of school food consumed over this period, almost all happening after the passage of the federal Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act in 2010, which mandated much stronger school and early child care nutrition standards. The findings represent food is actually consumed from different U.S. sources, not what is theoretically available to be purchased. In U.S. children from 2003 to 2018, the proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from restaurants declined least, from 85% to 80%. The proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from grocery stores declined modestly, from 53% to 45%. The proportion of poor quality nutritional quality food consumed from schools was cut by more than half, from 57% to 24%. Significant disparities were seen in improvements in food consumed from grocery stores, with greater improvements among whites than Blacks or Hispanics, and among children in households with greater family income or heads of households with higher educational attainment than with lower income or education. In contrast, improvements in food consumed from schools were equitable by race, ethnicity, education, and household income. Our results underscore the fact that the nutritional quality of most meals, snacks, and drinks consumed in the U.S. remains poor, and with important differences by where the food is obtained. Improvement in schools was especially striking, large, and equitable across population subgroups. This is clearly linked to the 2010 Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, a powerful lesson on how a single federal policy could improve both nutrition and equity for millions of Americans. These findings are especially timely with the new focus of the presidential administration, USDA, and Congress on nutrition security. The nutritional improvements in foods obtained at schools came from kids eating more of what's good for them, such as whole grains, total fruits, greens and beans, and less of what's harmful, such as sugary drinks, refined grains, and foods with added sugars, said first author, Jiang Xiaolu, a postdoctoral school at the Friedman School. These were the specific targets of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. Despite these improvements, school meals only provided 9% of calories for the average child over the course of an entire year, highlighting the importance of improving the nutritional quality of food choices from other sources. Grocery stores accounted for 65% of calories of children and 67% for adults, followed by restaurants at 19% of calories for children and 22% of calories for adults. Other sources, such as gifts from others, food trucks, and entertainment venues, represented 8% of calories for children and 9% for adults. Additional results for U.S. adults from 2003 to 2018 include: the proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from restaurants remained relatively stable at 65%. The proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from workplaces declined modestly from 56% to 51%. The proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from grocery stores declined modestly from 40% to 33%. COVID-19 has changed the equation for where Americans are getting their food. Grocery stores were the main source before the pandemic, a trend that has only accelerated, including online. Restaurants that have survived the pandemic are now reopening. This is a perfect time to take stock of our food sources and choices as a nation and find policy solutions to put better nutrition on the table for all Americans. And next up, in a somewhat related story from Science Daily, time to shift from food security to nutrition security to increase health and well-being. In the 1960s, a national focus on hunger was essential to address major problems of undernutrition after World War II. In the 1990s, the nation shifted away from hunger toward food insecurity to better capture and address the challenges of food access and affordability. Now, a new Viewpoint article argues that today's health and equity challenges call for the U.S. to shift from food insecurity to nutrition insecurity in order to catalyze appropriate focus and policies on access not just to food, but to healthy, nourishing food. The Viewpoint by Darius Mozafarian of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University was published online in JAMA. The concept of food security focuses on access to and affordability of food that is safe, nutritious, and consistent with personal preferences. In reality, however, the nutritious part has often been overlooked or lost in national policies and solutions, with resulting emphasis on quantity rather than quality of food, says the authors. Food is essential both for life and human dignity. Every day I see hunger, but the hunger I see is not only for calories, but for nourishing meals. With a new focus on nutrition security, we embrace a solution that nourishes people instead of filling them with food but leaving them hungry, said Chef Jose Andre, founder of World Central Kitchen. The authors define nutrition security as having consistent access to and availability and affordability of foods and beverages that promote well-being while preventing it and, if needed, treating disease. Nutrition security provides a more inclusive view that recognizes that foods must nourish all people. Nutrition security incorporates all the aims of food security, but with additional emphasis on the need for wholesome, healthful foods and drinks for all. COVID-19 has made clear that Americans who are more likely to be hungry are also at highest risk of diet-related diseases, including obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and many cancers, a harsh legacy of inequities and structural racism in our nation. A new focus on nutrition security for all Americans will help crystallize and catalyze real solutions that provide not only food, but also well-being for everyone, the first author, Darius Mozafarian, said. It's the right time for this evolution. By prioritizing nutrition security, we bring together historically siloed areas, hunger and nutrition, which must be tackled together to effectively address our modern challenge of diet-related diseases and disparities in clinical care, government food and food assistance policies, public health investments, and national research. The current approach is not sufficient, the authors write. And traditionally marginalized minority groups, as well as people living in rural and lower income counties, are most likely to experience disparities in nutrition quality, food insecurity, and corresponding diet-related diseases. So folks, food is more than just about quantity. We got to think about nutritional quality as well. Long way to go. Let's get to it. Okay folks, we'll perk up. Here's an interesting story that offers a free resource as well from Science Daily. How to gain a sense of well-being free and online. That's what I love. In 2018, when Professor Lori Santos introduced her course, Psychology and the Good Life, a class on the science of happiness, it became the most popular in the history of Yale, attracting more than 1,200 undergraduate enrollees that first semester. An online course based on those teachings became a global phenomenon. By latest count, 3.4 million people have enrolled to take the free Coursera.org course called The Science of Well-Being. I'll repeat that at the end of the story. But the popularity of the course posed an interesting question. Does taking the course and participating in homework assignments, which include nurturing social connections, compiling a gratitude list, and meditation, really help improve a sense of well-being? The answer is yes. According to two new studies that measured the psychological impact on individuals who took Santos or a similar course, the findings suggest that free online courses that teach principles of positive psychology can enrich the lives of millions of people. The classes are not a substitute for professional treatment for those who suffer from diagnosed mental illness. These courses are not a panacea or replacement for psychotherapy or medication. However, the findings show that massive open online courses can provide at least modest value to millions of people at no cost. We wanted to know if we could scale these benefits, and we can. Even bringing a small mental health benefit to millions of people can have a huge value. So if you want to check that out, you can go to Coursera.org, that's Coursera.org, and look for the course called The Science of Well-Being, Coursera.org. And in more good news, for what could have been really bad news, this from National Geographic. Children born to Chernobyl survivors don't carry more genetic mutations. On the morning of April 26, 1986, a reactor in a nuclear power plant in what's now northern Ukraine exploded and burned, triggering what would become history's deadliest nuclear accident. The hellish fire belched out immense clouds of radioactive fallout that entered people's lungs, settled on homes, fields, and livestock pastures, and infiltrated their supplies. Milk, salami, and eggs had become, in the words of one nuclear engineer, a radioactive byproduct. In the years since, researchers have monitored the health of populations that lived through the Chernobyl disaster, from people in nearby towns to the liquidators who cleaned up and built a huge concrete sarcophagus over the site. Nearly 35 years later, an international team has taken an extensive look at the disaster's genetic effects, and the resulting pair of studies has found reassuring new details. Allaying long-held fears over how the disaster could affect future generations, the largest study of its kind ever conducted, published in Science, finds no evidence that parents who were exposed to Chernobyl's radiation passed on any excess mutations to children conceived after exposure. Researchers hope the findings will benefit other populations affected by nuclear accidents, such as those displaced by the 2011 meltdown of Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. If there is a deleterious mutation, it's going to be rare. We can't say it's never going to happen, but we don't see this as a common public health crisis, said both studies' senior author Stephen Chenock, the director of the U.S. National Cancer Institute's Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics. We think the findings should be reassuring. While the paper cannot totally exclude that such effects could occur, it is clear from this study that risks are substantially lower than currently believed, said Robert Ulrich, the vice chairman of the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, a U.S.-Japanese cooperative based in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Ulrich was not involved with the studies. And in more news from Medical Express, even so-called safe ambient carbon monoxide levels may harm health, study finds. Data collected from 337 cities across 18 countries show that even slight increases in ambient carbon monoxide levels from automobiles and other sources are associated with increased mortality. The research published in The Lancet Planetary Health also found that even short-term exposure to ambient carbon monoxide at levels below the current air quality guidelines and considered safe had an association with increased mortality. The findings reveal that there is no evidence for a threshold value below which the exposure to ambient carbon monoxide can be considered, quote, safe. The study's findings strongly suggest the need to revisit global and national air quality standards for carbon monoxide, and in addition to single pollutant standards, policy should be expanded to address traffic-related air pollution mixtures. These findings have significant public health implications. Millions and millions of people live in environments with elevated carbon monoxide levels and in environments where the carbon monoxide levels are within the current guidelines considered, quote, safe range. This from Medical Express. Music improves older adults' sleep quality. I'm personally fond of this one since I often listen to music before I go to bed. Listening to music before going to bed can improve sleep quality among older adults according to an analysis of all relevant published clinical trials. In the analysis, which is published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, 5 randomized trials met the investigators' criteria. Older adults who listened to music experienced significantly better sleep quality than those who did not listen to music. Also, older adults who listened to sedative music experienced a greater improvement in sleep quality than those who listened to more rhythmic music. Furthermore, listening to music for longer than 4 weeks was especially effective at improving sleep quality. Music intervention is an effective strategy and is easy to administer by the caregiver or healthcare worker, the authors wrote. Music therapy might be the first line of therapy to recommend in older adults with sleep disturbances, which could reduce the need for dependence on sedatives and sleeping medication. Woohoo! Music, the universal language. No surprise, it's good for us. And another story that may be of little surprise to some people, this from Science Daily. Spanking may affect the brain development of a child. Spanking may affect a child's brain development in similar ways to more severe forms of violence, according to a new study led by Harvard researchers. The research published in the journal Child Development builds on existing studies that show heightened activity in certain regions of the brains of children who experience abuse in response to threat cues. We know that children whose families use corporal punishment are more likely to develop anxiety, depression, behavior problems, and other mental health problems. But many people don't think about spanking as a form of violence, said Katie McLaughlin, director of the Stress and Development Lab in the Department of Psychology and senior researcher on the study. According to the study's authors, corporal punishment has been linked to the development of mental health issues, anxiety, depression, behavioral problems, and substance use disorders. And recent studies show that approximately half of parents in the U.S. reported spanking their children in the past year and one-third in the past week. However, the relationship between spanking and brain activity has not previously been studied. The findings are in line with a similar research conducted on children who had experienced severe violence, suggesting that while we might not conceptualize corporal punishment to be a form of violence, in terms of how a child's brain responds, it's not all that different than abuse, said McLaughlin. It's more a difference of degree than of type. Ultimately, added McLaughlin, we're hopeful that this finding may encourage families not to use this strategy, and that it may open people's eyes to the potential negative consequences of corporal punishment in ways that they haven't thought of before. This from Medical Express. The clear message on promoting body positivity. Public health campaigns that challenge weight stigma and promote body positivity can boost the health and well-being for people of all body sizes, according to a University of Queensland study. The School of Psychology scholar Joanne Rathbone had led the project to examine how different public health messages affect people's behaviors. Public health messages often encourage weight loss and focus on the risks that excess weight might pose to health, which can be stigmatizing. We looked at how alternative ways of framing public health messages affected people and compared those outcomes with those from typical weight loss messages. The alternative messages we tested either did not mention weight, explicitly targeted people of all body sizes without focusing on weight loss, or challenge weight stigma, encourage body positivity and size acceptance. We examined how these different public health messages affected people's perceptions of weight stigma, their motivation to engage in healthy behaviors like eating fruits and vegetables and exercising, and unhealthy behaviors that are associated with disordered eating like skipping meals or purging. We also asked people about their body satisfaction and self-esteem after viewing these messages. Ms. Rathbone said the alternative messages did not affect everyone equally. They affected health behaviors and well-being differently depending on the actual or perceived weight of the audience, she said. Removing mention of weight from the message only had a positive impact for people with a lower weight. Messages that targeted people of all body sizes without focusing on weight loss increased higher weight people's motivation to engage in healthy behaviors. For lower weight people, these messages made them feel less satisfied with their bodies. Messages that challenged weight stigma and encouraged body positivity and size acceptance had a predominantly positive effect on psychological well-being for people of all body sizes. However, these messages also reduced motivation for healthy behaviors that are often associated with weight loss and reduced body satisfaction for lower weight people. Ms. Rathbone said, public health campaigns need to move away from focusing on weight loss and should avoid using weight stigmatizing content. Past research has indicated time and time again that public health messages that focus on weight loss and use weight stigmatizing content are unlikely to be effective at encouraging healthy behaviors. In fact, the evidence suggests that these messages can actually be harmful to people's health and well-being. There are alternative, non-stigmatizing ways in which we can frame public health messages, but there is no one-size-fits-all approach. Careful consideration needs to be given to the weight-related framing of public health messages based on the goals that these messages are trying to achieve and the target audience. Just another example of how non-judgmental attitudes are very important in effective public health practice. Okay, well, this next story scares the bejeebers out of me, both as a legacy issue spanning generations that continues to this very day. This from CBS News. How a shocking environmental disaster was uncovered off the California coast after 70 years. Just 10 miles off the coast of Los Angeles lurks an environmental disaster over 70 years in the making, which few have ever heard about. That is until now, thanks to the research of a University of California marine scientist named David Valentine. Working with little more than rumors and a hunch, curiosity guided him to 3,000 feet below the ocean's surface. A few hours of research time and an autonomous robotic submersible unearthed what had been hidden since the 1940s. Countless barrels of toxic waste, laced with DDT, littering the ocean floor in between Long Beach and Catalina Island. The fact that his underwater camera spotted dozens of decaying barrels immediately in what is otherwise a barren, desert-like seafloor, Valentine says, is evidence that the number of barrels is likely immense. Although the exact number is still unknown, a historical account estimates it may be as many as 500,000 barrels. After 70-plus years of inaction, Valentine's research has helped initiate a huge research effort to reveal the extent of the contamination. But this offshore dump site is only part of the story of environmental damage from years of DDT discharge along the coast of Southern California, a story which likely won't be closed for decades to come because of its ongoing impact, including a recently discovered alarming and unprecedented rate of cancer in the state's sea lion population, with one in every four adult sea lions plagued with the disease. The history of DDT dumping. The chemical DDT was invented in 1939 and used during World War II as a pesticide, helping to protect troops from insect-borne diseases like malaria. After the war, production of the chemical ramped up, and it became routinely used in the spraying of crops and even overcrowded beaches to eliminate pests like mosquitoes. But in the 1960s, DDT was discovered to be toxic. Over time, eating food laced with DDT builds up inside the tissues of animals and humans, resulting in harmful side effects. The EPA now calls it, quote, a probable human carcinogen. That's an understatement. In 1972, when the U.S. government started taking environmental pollution seriously with legislation like the Clean Air Act, DDT was banned in the United States. The largest DDT manufacturer in the U.S., Montrose Chemical Corporation, was located along the Southern California coast in the city of Torrance. From 1947 through 1982, Montrose manufactured and distributed DDT worldwide. In doing so, a byproduct mix of toxic sludge made up of petrochemicals, DDT, and PCBs was produced. For decades, that hazardous waste was disposed of in two ways. Some of the toxic pollution was dumped into storm drains and the sewer system, which was then pumped out to sea through outflow pipes 2 miles offshore of the city of Rancho Palos Verdes. The rest of the waste was disposed of in barrels, which were loaded onto barges and floated 10 to 15 miles offshore to waste dumping sites off Catalina Island and then jettisoned into the ocean. While it may seem hard to believe, at least part of the dumping was legally permitted. Back then, Valentine says, the prevailing thought was that the oceans were so huge that they could never be compromised. Their mantra was, dilution is the solution to pollution. In hindsight, a naive notion. But while the designated dumping site was very deep, in 3,000 feet of water, Valentine says shortcuts were taken, with barrels being dumped much closer to shore. And in an effort to get the barrels to sink, there is evidence that many were slashed, allowing poison to leak as they were dropped into the ocean. For decades, the existence of these toxic barrels was surmised only by a very small group of scientists and regulators. That's despite a startling report produced in the 1980s by a California Regional Water Quality Control Board scientist named Alan Chartrand, which asserted there may be as many as 500,000 barrels laced with DDT sitting on the ocean floor. The report was largely ignored, but after nearly 30 years, Valentine dusted it off as he began his quest to see if these barrels existed. Despite the fact that the toxic barrels were dumped in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, their existence just became common knowledge this past fall when the Los Angeles Times published a feature on Valentine's work. But his discovery dates all the way back to 2011, when he first decided to see if the rumors of the barrels were true. In 2013, he made another trip to the site, but his research was not published until March of 2019. In all, his time-limited work yielded visuals of 60 barrels. Besides bringing back video of the leaking barrels, his team was also able to collect samples from the ocean floor. One of them registered a contamination 40 times greater than the highest contamination at the Superfund site, indicating that the toxins down deep are still very concentrated. Armed with this compelling evidence, Valentine said that he beat the drum for years, speaking to various government agencies, trying to get some interest, but to no avail. However, when the LA Times story came out, interest finally followed as public outcry grew. As of our last conversation with Eric Terrell, the team leader, the final number had still not been tallied, but even as early as a week into the research mission, Terrell described detecting tens of thousands of targets and said the numbers of barrels seems overwhelming. Located right near the Golden Gate Bridge, the mission of the Marine Mammal Center of Sausalito, California, is to rescue marine animals in distress. Since 1975, the organization says they have rescued 24,000. In December, the team published a 30-year study on sea lions, finding an alarming statistic. 25% of adult sea lions have cancer. CBS News interviewed the lead veterinarian, Dr. Kara Field. She called the number of sea lions with cancer both extremely alarming and unprecedented in wildlife. While there are still many unanswered questions, one lesson from the story of DDT contamination is clear. When humans callously pollute the environment, it can have consequences for generations to come. One current example is human-caused climate change. The question is, how much of a burden will our children and grandchildren have to bear as a result of our choices? This is from Dr. David Katz, The Cents and Dollars of Food as Medicine. What would you call the following scenario? A nation of families spends a portion of their income on poor quality food that routinely makes them sick and kills them prematurely. Employers, insurance companies, and the government help most of them pay for the drugs and treatments necessary to treat the conditions caused in large measure by, quote, bad food. The cost of treatment for conditions hardly anyone needed to get in the first place routinely exceed the cost of the food largely responsible for engendering those conditions. Perhaps crazy comes to mind? Bizarre? Nuts? Outrageous? Absurd? Ridiculous? Preposterous? I would call it just another day in America. Just another day in much of the modern world, for that matter. Because the substitution of disease-inducing junk where food ought to be is not only a substantially American invention, but a very lucrative export. We have done our utmost to sell the amalgam of food as an assault on public health and medicine as remedy to anyone remotely capable of buying it. There is a better way. In rebuttal to this massive outrage hiding in plain sight, an outrage that has made adult-onset diabetes a quotidian diagnosis in our children, that is seemingly a quite bland statement, that almost any way would be better way, would be a better way, all but screams at us. But we are seemingly blind to the outrage and deaf to the screams. So perhaps a bland statement may better serve the urgency. Just as a whisper is at times better at attracting attention than a yell, there is a better way. First, let's revisit my use of, quote, bad as a descriptor for food above. The case has often been propounded by ostensible authorities that there's no such thing. I beg to differ. Ultra-processed concoctions willfully engineered to be addictive are, in a word, bad. And let's take it further. Bad is as bad does. Whenever a given assembly of foods is salently implicated among the causes of chronic morbidity and or premature mortality, as the typical American diet most assuredly is, then it is bad. This is not a moral judgment. It is a verdict predicated on consequences. The flight path is in substantially slower motion, but this is bad in just the way that a bullet hole through the chest is bad. Bad outcomes of eating per routine in America prevail, and thus, ipso facto, bad food prevails. Food is not supposed to ravage organ systems, propagate degeneration of body parts, or accelerate our surrender to senescence. We will eventually succumb to these forces no matter how well we eat and live, but the blue zone shows us how vibrantly and how long a well-nourished, well-tended body is apt to defend itself. There's nothing genetically special about blue zone populations. The, quote, blessings they enjoy, a greater bounty of years in life, a far greater bounty of life in years, unencumbered by the chronic disease they routinely avoid, are courtesy of lifestyle. In principle, a salutary diet and lifestyle is an option for all. In practice, however, this is not the case. The choices people make, whatever our level of personal responsibility and self-discipline, are subordinate to the choices people have. Aggressively peddle willfully addictive junk food and normalize the notion that chronic disease is a societal rite of passage, polypharmacy an inevitable consequence of reaching midlife, and the good choices people otherwise might make reside on the remote side of a bridge too far. The SNAP program, directed at nearly 1 in 7 American families struggling to put adequate food on the table, might be considered the highly visible tip of the same iceberg threatening to sink us all. I fully support SNAP as a partial remedy for a culture that cultivates massive socioeconomic disparities and preferentially markets obesity and chronic disease for profit to those who can least afford the toll. But a dispassionate appraisal shows how deranged the status quo is. We, the American taxpayers, spend tens of billions of dollars to subsidize SNAP, and thereby help relatively poor people secure access to horribly poor food, and thus achieve dreadfully poor health. We then spend many more tens and hundreds of billions of dollars through Medicaid to treat that poor health, and all too often do it poorly. If you can spot the winner in this scenario, the golden jelly beans are all yours. We might, instead, provide easy-to-understand guidance to better quality foods, financial incentives to choose it, and nip this whole noxious bloom in the bud. We have cause to hope as well that there may indeed be a silver lining when the dark clouds of the COVID pandemic finally part, a bright light shining on the acute liabilities of chronic cardiometabolic ill health. Among the pandemic's lessons is this: there is an acute case for chronic vitality. Those opposed to delayed gratification, take note and take heart. The benefits of food as medicine, rather than as preamble to the need for medications, confer gratification right away, before turning into the gift that keeps on giving. The powers that be, big food, big pharma, may not like this, but it is merely an expression of a free market mantra, adapt or die. There's no reason food can't be both big and good, and no reason why the assets of pharma cannot diversify to investment in the right kinds of farms, just as big energy must now diversify to green or suffer the fate of the obsolete. Whether ill or well, nearly everyone who can eats nearly every day. The cost of eating, something, are thus fixed costs. The costs of food to nurture rather than degrade health are limited accordingly to the cost difference between bad and good food. The incremental cost, already apt to be vastly less than the cost of ill health as usual, would decline further with time as our food supply shifted its emphasis to the production of good. We could, if so inclined, monetize a revolutionary transition from our current disease care system to a system of literal health care. We could more readily transition from the dual cost of medication to fix only partly all the part of us food keeps breaking. Food is the medicine long ago invoked by Hippocrates, could save lives, vitality, biodiversity, and a vast fortune into the bargain. The drumbeat tolls of necessity in the guise of diabetes, heart disease, obesity, cancer, dementia, climate change, and the acutely calamitous toll of COVID as well, we may, whenever so inclined, invoke the will to invent the better way. Okay, well, like I like to say, go big or go home. And sticking with that theme, this from Science Daily: new approach to understanding our well-being. The ability to connect and feel a sense of belonging are basic human needs, But new Swansea University research has examined how they are determined by more than just our personal relationships. Research led by psychologist Professor Andrew Kemp of the College of Human and Health Sciences highlights the importance of taking a wider approach to well-being and how it can be influenced by issues such as inequality and anthropogenic climate change. That's human-caused climate change. Globalization, urbanization, and technological advancements have meant that humans have become increasingly disconnected from nature. This continues despite research showing that contact with nature improves well-being. The research reveals that advantages to health and well-being derive from connecting to oneself, others, and nature, and emphasizes a need for focused efforts to tackle major societal issues that affect our capacity for connection. He added, "The poorest are disproportionately impacted by major societal challenges, including increasing burden of chronic diseases, societal loneliness, and human-caused climate change. Economic inequality has adverse effects on the entire population, not just the poor, so improving economic inequality is fundamental to improving population well-being." Yes, my friends, we have an alienation epidemic. This from Medical Express. Providing medications for free leads to greater adherence and cost savings, study shows. Well, who'd have thunk? Free access to essential medicines increases patients' adherence by taking medication by 35% and reduces total health spending by an average of over $1,000 per patient per year, according to a two-year study that tested the effects of providing patients with free and convenient access to a carefully selected set of medications. The findings, published in PLOS Medicine, comes as advocates urge Canada to carve a path towards single-payer public pharmacare. Canada is the only country with universal health care that does not have a universal pharmacare program. The cost savings are substantial, but they are less important than people simply being able to afford taking life-saving medications, said Dr. Nav Persaud, a scientist at the Li Ka-shing Knowledge Institute of St. Michael's Hospital and the lead author of the study. "This is the first study of providing people with free access to a comprehensive set of medicines, and hopefully it will be the last one needed before policy changes," said Dr. Persaud, who is also a family physician at St. Michael's Hospital. In June 2019, the Advisory Council on the Implementation of National PharmaCare recommended a universal single-payer public pharmacare, estimating such a program could save Canada an estimated $5 billion per year. So that's savings in a system of universal health care that doesn't have pharmacare, and Canada is unusual in that respect, as it's the only nation that has universal health care that doesn't have universal pharmacare. And it just goes to show that you're only as strong as your weakest link. Of course, in the U.S., we'd have something called like the Medicare donut hole and all the different supplementary plans that are needed to get pharmaceuticals and other coverage. But the bottom line is that universal pharmaceutical coverage is more cost-effective, free, than through market-based solutions, so-called solutions. Universal healthcare now. Of course, medications have to work for them to be cost-effective. This next from Science Daily. Long-term use of prescription meds for insomnia not linked to better quality sleep. Long-term use of prescription meds for insomnia doesn't seem to improve disturbed sleep in middle-aged women, suggests research published in the online journal BMJ Open. There was no difference in sleep quality or duration between those who did and didn't take these meds for 1 to 2 years, the findings show. Disturbed sleep, difficulty falling, and or staying awake and waking early is common. An estimated 9 million adults in the U.S. alone say they take prescription meds to try and get a good night's sleep. Poor quality sleep is associated with ill health, including diabetes, high blood pressure, pain, and depression, and various drugs are prescribed to induce shut-eye. These include benzodiazepines, Z drugs, which include zolpidem, zoloplan, and esopiclone, as well as other agents mostly intended for other conditions, that is, off-label use, such as quelling anxiety and depression. The clinical trial data indicate that many of these drugs work in the short term, up to 6 months, but insomnia can be chronic, and many people take these drugs for longer, says the researchers. Nevertheless, conclude the researchers, sleep disturbances are common and increasing in prevalence. The use of sleep medications has grown, and they are often used over long periods of time, despite the relative lack of evidence from randomized controlled trials. Next up from The Guardian. number of smokers has reached all-time high of 1.1 billion, study finds. That's worldwide. Smoking killed almost 8 million people in 2019, and the number of smokers rose as the habit was picked up by young people around the world, according to new research. A study published in The Lancet said efforts to curb the habit had been outstripped by population growth, with 150 more people smoking in the 9 years from 1990, reaching an all-time high of 1.1 billion. The study authors and governments need to focus on reducing the uptake of smoking among young people, as 89% of new smokers were addicted by the age of 25, but beyond that age were unlikely to start. Young people are particularly vulnerable to addiction, and with high rates of cessation remaining elusive worldwide, the tobacco epidemic will continue for years to come unless countries can dramatically reduce the number of new smokers starting each year. The study's lead author, Marissa Reitzma, a researcher at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, said, "Though the prevalence of smoking has reduced globally over the past three decades, it's increased for men in 20 countries and for women in 12. Just 10 countries make up two-thirds of the world's smoking population: China, India, Indonesia, the U.S., Russia, Bangladesh, Japan, Turkey, Vietnam, and the Philippines. One in three smokers, 341 million, live in China. In 2019, smoking was associated with 1.7 million deaths from ischemic heart disease, 1.6 million deaths from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, 1.3 million deaths from tracheal, bronchus, or lung cancer, and nearly 1 million deaths from stroke. Previous studies have shown that at least half of long-term smokers will die from causes directly linked to smoking, and that smokers have an average life expectancy 10 years lower than those who have never smoked. According to the study, half of all countries had made no progress in stopping uptake among 15 to 24-year-olds, and the average age for someone to start was 19 when it is legal in most places. Despite 182 countries signing a 2005 Convention on Tobacco Control, enforcing policies to reduce smoking has been varied. Researchers said taxation was the most effective policy, but there was significant discrepancy between the high cost of a packet of cigarettes in developed countries and a significantly lower cost in low and middle-income countries. The study's co-author, Vin Gupta, said there needed to be a stronger commitment to tackling smoking, as well as products such as flavored cigarettes and e-cigarettes that are enticing to young people. Despite progress in some countries, tobacco industry interference and waning political commitment have resulted in a large and persistent gap between knowledge and action on global tobacco control, said Gupta. Bans on advertising, promotion, and sponsorship must extend to internet-based media, but only one in four countries have comprehensively banned all forms of direct and indirect advertising. Okay, well, while the United States has made much more progress than many other countries, tobacco is still the single largest preventable cause of death in this country. And we get this from the American Heart Association. Leading global cardiovascular organizations released joint opinion on achieving the, quote, tobacco endgame. Tobacco use continues to be a primary contributor to the global burden of disease, causing an estimated 12% of deaths worldwide among people aged 30 and over. Four leading cardiovascular organizations, the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, the European Society of Cardiology, and the World Heart Federation, released a joint opinion calling for greater action on the global scale to end the tobacco epidemic once and for all. The organizations are urging governments to take immediate action to implement the World Health Organization's M-Power framework, which outlines six essential policy approaches proven to reduce tobacco use: monitor tobacco use and prevention policies, protect people from tobacco smoke, offer help to quit tobacco use, warn about the dangers of tobacco, enforce bans of tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship, and raise taxes on tobacco. The joint opinion outlines comprehensive tobacco prevention strategies that are necessary to fully implement the M-Power framework, including lowering the nicotine concentrations in all combustible tobacco products, further research to understand the health impacts of nicotine on the cardiovascular system and the long-term effects of electronic cigarettes, enforcement of strong systems and pre-market assessments of all tobacco products, strong regulation of tobacco industry marketing to ensure false health claims are not made about products that have not been thoroughly researched and authorized through regulatory review, greater global action to remove all non-tobacco-flavored products from the market, raising the price of all tobacco products through excise taxes and other means. Youth-targeted counter-marketing campaigns to effectively reduce tobacco use among youth. Access to comprehensive, evidence-based cessation services as a safer alternative for adults who wish to quit smoking combustible cigarettes. Despite global reductions in tobacco use, the growing popularity of electronic cigarettes and other newer tobacco products that appeal to youth with flavoring threatens progress towards ending tobacco use and nicotine addiction. The tobacco end game. Countries must effectively regulate electronic cigarettes and other emerging tobacco products to protect young people and improve public health worldwide. And for you listeners who yourself or have friends who are trying to quit smoking, you can call and get assistance free from 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, that does it for the Greatest Hit Show number 6 from April and May of 2021. Thanks for joining me. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London, and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-